The Women of Ill Repute, with your hosts, Wendy Mesley and Maureen Holloway.
Wendy, I don't know if you know this. You should know this, but you probably don't. One of my social media handles or names is Mouthy Babe.
I did not know that. You don't use it very much.
No, I don't. My kids hate it for all sorts of Freudian reasons. Like, you know, Mom, you're not a babe, and I don't want to hear about your mouth.
But you're still a babe.
Oh, yeah. That sort of goes without saying. But I will happily pass that handle on to this week's guest, Jen Gerson.
Jen Gerson, she's a lot of things to a lot of people. She's a Calgary-based commentator. She's written for The New York Times, The Economist, Maclean's, The Walrus, all the big publications, like a few Canadian papers.
Along with Matt Gurney, Jen hosts a podcast called The Line, which can be found on Substack, along with much of her writing. And I would go so far as to say that Jen is a scourge in all the right ways. She's not afraid to speak up and be highly critical of our governments, our media, religion, foreign policy.
Yeah, well, she talks a lot about freedom of speech, about conspiracy theories, and how to make your own makeup.
You can make your own makeup?
Apparently. Well, yeah, anything. You can make anything.
You need wax and fish scales. I know that.
So you've made some?
No, I've read about it, but but I digress. Jen has been working on among many projects. She's got a book, or she's working on a book on the satanic panic, the witch hunt that started back in the 80s when people believed that there were satanic cults that were preying on children. Some believe it's still ongoing. No shortage of topics, makeup notwithstanding, with this week's guest. So really hard to know where to start.
Yeah, well, Jen has been on our wish list since the very beginning. We can talk to her about the book. Jen is going to join us now. Hi, Jen. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me. Gosh, that's quite the introduction. Lovely. Now that you mention it, I guess I do have a lot going on.
Yeah, and you got a couple of kids.
Mm-hmm. Yep, two kids, 7 and 4 now. So great age. Wow. Great age to be running your own business, starting your own business and writing a book, of course.
Oh, for sure.
I'm killing it on every front, let me tell you.
Well, I sort of had to talk Maureen into doing this because, like, politics is not what we talk about. We don't talk a lot about daily news on this podcast. We talk,
well, thank
we
God, interview. I can use a break.
We talk, yeah, well, and you do, but you are a little bit mouthy. So I thought the two of you would get along.
No? My husband really likes that about me, but, you know, whatever. Screw him. What does he know?
What did you say that you were disagreeably agreeable, or was that something that somebody pinned on you?
I'm pretty sure that's the sort of thing that someone would pin on me. I mean, the funny thing is that I have a bit of a persona online, which is sort of shitposting, fearless, devil-may-care kind of attitude. But the funny thing is, like, my offline self, I am a lamb. Like, in fact, the really hilarious thing is that I almost never get into arguments. I never really fight. I mean, there are a couple of exceptions, but, like, I'm very peaceable. I'm very easygoing. I'm very chill, probably to a degree that is absolutely pernicious. And I'm actually starting to think about this. It's like I'm coming up on 40 now, and I started to suddenly realize that maybe I should be less, it should be a little less agreeable.
Oh, no, I disagree. I may not agree. And Wendy is right. I'm not politically, I'm one of the few people that would say, I don't know enough about this to have an informed opinion. And I think there should be more of that. But that being said, you know, I read you and although our politics are quite different, I find myself nodding. You make a good point. When you're in a social situation, though, lamb that you are, do people come up to you and say, "Who do you think you are with these opinions?"
No. If anything, I mean, maybe it's also because I'm in Alberta, right? But overwhelmingly, firstly, I think I give off a bit of a weird vibe. I think I come across as quite aloof when I'm in social circumstances, which is interesting because actually, it's genuinely shyness. I'm really uncomfortable in groups of people. But I think people can take that the wrong way. But when they do come up, they're generally quite like, I don't always agree. I get this a lot. I don't always agree with you, but you know, you make a good point. Or I get a lot of that. And I always find that to be an interesting response because I'm like, well, why would you ever expect to always agree with anyone? Like, I don't always agree with lots of people whom I enjoy reading or lots of people I enjoy spending time with. I don't always agree with my husband, and I tell them this. quite frequently.
Well, I love that. I love being able to disagree with people. And I think it's really important. And it's really good to know that smart people have a different opinion than you do. So I don't agree with everything, but I agree with a lot of what you write. So, but I want to know, are you still writing? Like it's a pinned tweet from 2021 that you've got this book deal.
Yeah, so are
you or aren't you writing the
my
book?
My publisher will be happy to know. I just finished the draft of chapter 9.
Chapter 9.
It is coming. It is so slow. I was one of these people who, my first book deal, and I went to my publisher and I said, I'm not going to be like other writers. I'm going to be on this shit. I'm going to get you your full manuscript in a year. I'm going to be like chapter a month. Let's go. You know, I'm going to be this super aggressive. And of course, 3 years later, I'm not done.
On that. So I think you can take your time because the satanic panic, which is what we're talking about that you're writing about, doesn't seem to be dissipating as quickly as one would think it might be. There are a lot of people, particularly with Trump running for office again, who think that this is a real thing and that he is one of the finger pointers.
Yeah. So this is a really interesting thing because when I started writing about this because Tristan Hopper, who was the editor in chief of The Capital, which is an independent kind of online only outlet in Victoria, he's a delightful weirdo and a national treasure. And he's really into history. And one of the things that he was looking into was the history of Victoria. And he discovered that, for example, one of the origins of the satanic panic conspiracy theory really took off because of a book that was based in Victoria. It was
BC, Victoria, BC.
Victoria, British Columbia. Yeah. So there was a woman named Michelle Proby and her doctor, Lawrence Pazder, who did a series he was a very credible, very, very well credentialed psychiatrist, I believe, with great track record. And he was doing these intensive therapy sessions with Proby. And he worked with her for a couple of years, and it was pretty conventional stuff. It was anxiety and depression, ordinary marital problems. But then out of the blue, I can't remember exactly what year it is now, I think 76, she had a miscarriage. And in the process of being in the miscarriage, she was in hospital. And while she was in hospital, she had this really disturbing dream of like spiders coming out of her skin. And this made Pazder think, well, geez, yeah, I mean, come on back. Let's start to delve into this. And so they started to get into this habit of this quasi-hypnotic style of therapy where she would go into these trance states. And in these trance states, she would start to regress to a 5-year-old version of herself who started to have these in real time living memories of being kidnapped by a satanic cult and forced to undergo no end of incredibly horrific spiritual and sexual and physical abuse over the course of several months. Because, of course, it came out that her mother was a member of the satanic cult and all this kind of crazy stuff happened. And she came to believe that this was really literally true. Pazder himself, who was a very devout Catholic, got really invested in the story. And it was also clear that they had developed this very intense rapport over the course of this therapy. I'll spoil it for you. In the end, they wind up leaving their respective spouses and get married with one another. But in the process of doing this, they write this book, and the pastor who is a Catholic, I mean, I think he is subconsciously feeding her a version of what he wants to hear, because of course her tales of satanic abuse have this paradoxical effect of reinforcing his own Roman Catholic faith. He drags her into Catholic Church. They get taken up by the archdiocese and eventually get taken to the Vatican to have her accounts, not necessarily confirmed, but heard out within the highest levels of the Vatican. And I believe the bishop of the Victorian archdiocese, who is a bishop, Remy Duroux, who recently died, he actually wrote a foreword to her book, which gave her the book all sorts of credibility for a lot of people. This thing goes on to be a radical bestseller. It's very rapidly debunked. She was never even out of school for the period of time that she claimed that she had been kidnapped by the satanic cult. But I mean, the end of the book had things like appendices from her dentist that claimed that, like, yes, there were issues with her teeth, and therefore this confirmed her account of having, you know, fangs put on her teeth, like crazy, crazy ass shit. And I mean, by the end of the book, she was also claiming that as a 5-year-old, she was having actual communion with the Holy Mother Mary. Like, it's
there's so many issues here.
So many issues.
I'm fascinated by the whole conspiracy theory angle of it all, because now, I mean, there are a number of conservatives in the States, evangelicals, whatever, who believe that Democrats are having children in the basement. Like, they're all Satanists.
Part and, of a cabal.
Yeah, and it goes on and on and on and on. And you can debunk it all you want, but it doesn't even make a difference these days. Well, so I'm just...
And here's where it gets really fascinating, because you can look at see how this book created and contributed to the satanic panic of what we generally call the sort of the 80s and into the 90s is kind of when that period went. But all of the cultural zeitgeist that had prepared for the satanic panic, all the groundwork with that was being laid through the 60s and 70s, the Cultural Revolution, the rise of sort of occultism, the rise of alternative religious faiths. You had the Marilyn Manson stuff. You had the rise of second wave feminism. So you had women heading back into the workplace. You had women going back and putting their kids in daycares. There was a whole sort of cultural tension that was happening as a result of that. And the satanic panic was kind of this reactionary backlash to all of that. But what really gets messed up here is when you start to really dig into it, you start to realize that the actual conspiracy theory, which is a little bit different from the ordinary witch hunt conspiracy theories, it's a little distinct, but the actual conspiracy theory itself, which is that, you know, people in power are worshiping Satan, sacrificing children in order for their own debauched and debased pleasure and or to gain satanic power within society. And this explains how they gain power within society. I think the first real example of that coming out goes back to like 1682 and something called the Affair of the Poisons.
What's wrong with us? So now we've got conspiracy theories coming out the yin yang.
Yeah, and my theory is that the satanic panic essentially never really ended. It just evolved, right? Like it kind of went through a denouement. It became less mainstream for 20, 30 years for sure. It became a fringe conspiracy theory. But there's something about this particular conspiracy that speaks to our horrors and our dark side in such a profound sense that it never really leaves us. It never goes away. It's just always kind of simmering there beneath the surface.
This takes it, if you take this to a broader context, and my mind's going all over the place thinking about, there are none so blind that those who won't see, or as my son likes to see, there are nuns so blind they're Nazis. People are going to believe what they're going to believe. And this is true of Trumpers. It doesn't matter what you tell them. They're going to say, well, that's you just have to spend 3 minutes online just to see what people, it doesn't matter. And you must find, as a pundit, as a writer, that this is really frustrating because in many ways you are often preaching to the choir, that the people who read you are like, yeah, absolutely, are going to agree with you, when really what you want to do is not persuade, at least be heard by people who don't blindly accept.
Yeah, I don't see that as my role. I don't think it's my job to preach to anybody, and I don't think it's my job to convince anybody, right? Like, I just take a very different view on this, and maybe it's a bit more of a detached view, but it's my job to sort of explain what I think is happening. And people can take or leave that as it serves them. They can take whatever they find valuable out of that, and they can call me a bitch online if they don't like it. That's fine. I don't fundamentally see my role as trying to, because that's a very top-down way of thinking about a relationship between a pundit and his or her audience, right? It's, I'm here to tell you what, I'm not here to tell anybody what to think. I'm here to tell you what I think. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I'm selfish. I'm a selfish ass bitch, right? If you don't agree with me, that's fine. I don't care. But I mean, the other problem with the satanic panic conspiracy and the problem with conspiracies is that it's very easy to fall into the trap of thinking that it's all about those other people. Those other people who believe the wrong things.
You people.
You people. And what you start to realize when you study moral panics a little bit more is that it's a little more complicated than that, because moral panics aren't about you people who believe the wrong things. Moral panics are a dynamic. They're like a play. They're about basically, essentially, a real or perceived threat to the community that actually exists, but then is taken wildly out of disproportion. And then what you get is like a hyperpolarization around that issue. So it's not like you people believe these crazy QAnon conspiracies. It's you people who believe these crazy QAnon conspiracies engaging in a sort of perpetually radicalizing dynamic with the right people who think that you're just crazy and who in their zeal to debunk you are sometimes overlooking actual evidence of problems and harm. And the two sides wind up feeding off of each other and radicalizing off of each other into these more and more extreme camps. And that's what makes moral panics so completely destructive.
But is there then any way of stopping a moral panic, or it's just always existed since the 1600s, so it'll carry on forever?
I mean, I think that the cycle of moral panics is with us now. And I think that if anything, these cycles are accelerating. Like the satanic panic was sort of like a 15-year height cycle, right? And then it went back into the underground or the fringes. I think that we're seeing now is that with especially the social media and the way that communication operates with social media now, is that these cycles of moral panic are becoming more intense and more condensed. So now moral panic kind of has a 12 to 18 month cycle before it collapses, right? That's what I think we're seeing now.
I was really fascinated by a piece that you wrote about immigration and how, Canada had long presented itself as the place to come and start off a new life. And our doors are open, and it's very easy to be smug when we don't have borders that are, next to Mexico or whatever. Yeah. But you talk about it as sort of being irresistible catnip for politicians and almost like a conspiracy theory. And I just wonder if you could expand on that whole link of conspiracy theory, immigration, politics.
Wrap it all up.
So I just finished my chapter on this. So if you look at Michael Cohen's book, which I happen to have right here because I was just working from it. So this is sort of one of the seminal books on academic books on moral panics. And it's called Cohen, Folk Devils and Moral Panics. Highly recommend, not necessarily like a page turner, but it's a good book. And he notices that there are a couple of particular issues around which are seem to be particularly vulnerable for moral panics. One of them being immigration, refugee, asylum seeking, that kind of thing. The idea that if we let too many people in, this will be a threat to the mother culture. It's a threat to blah, 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 blah. The problem with this is that, of course, we do need to have a rational, grounded conversation, policy-driven conversation about immigration. There is a number at which we do run into issues around housing, around healthcare capacity, around all these sorts of other types of basic capacity issues. So we do need to have a policy-based immigration conversation here. But immigration is a particularly sensitive and vulnerable issue because it gets to, deep shadow kind of conversations around who we are as a society and whether or not other people who aren't like us are a threat to that society. And it starts to tap these like real lizard brain, hindbrain problems. And as a result, it's very easy for a really rational, policy-driven conversation around immigration to blow up into something that is radically disproportionate to the threat, quote unquote, threat that immigration poses, right?
So I'm not sure if you're saying there's a threat or there's not a threat.
No, I mean, well, look, I don't think it's about framing it as a threat is a moral panic kind of framing, right? But that's why the immigration is such a vulnerable topic to address. It's one of, I think, like seven particular issues that you tend to see moral panics circulate around. But it's a very easy topic where you get into this idea that, okay, we're going to have a rational conversation about immigration, but that hits on deep sort of emotional issues that people have around identity and collective identity and statehood and all of these things. And as a result, you wind up into these hyper-polarized camps that, again, wind up feeding off of one another and radicalizing off one another, with one side saying all the immigration is good and there is no policy component to this issue at all, and anybody who wants to stem or tide immigration at all is just a racist bigot, and the other side saying, my dudes, like, we can't house all these people, and also they tend to get radicalized into this position around Canadian national identity or home country native national identity, right? Nativism. Because this dynamic happens, what the conversation that doesn't happen is the one that's like, okay, but how many immigrants should we be taking? Should it be 100,000? Should it be 300,000? Should it be a million? Like, what's the correct number here? And like,
and instead we're talking about white supremacism and the replacement theory and
white supremacists and white replacement theory, right? So it becomes really
what do you
hard
call
to
them?
Have
This is very Jenny called the pasties. I love that.
Well, sure. But I mean, this becomes the issue. Immigration isn't the only one of these topics that this tends to happen around. I mean, Cohen notes, for example, sex, violence, delinquent teens. The media itself is often a subject of moral panics over time. I would add to his list, LGBTQ issues have a tendency to create this kind of moral panic dynamic. And as a result, when we're dealing with those types of topics, it can be really hard to have grounded conversations on these things without getting swept up into one side or the other. Right.
Yeah. So is that the world that we live in now of yeah. politicians taking advantage of the immigration instead of coming up with a policy to solve things?
But it's not just politicians so taking easy. Advantage. There's an issue. Yeah. That's the problem. That's the other thing that you find consistently when you research moral panics. They don't exist in a vacuum. People didn't just like come up one day and say the Satanists are after my kids. There was a rise in open and public Satanism. Like there were actual a handful of genuinely what I would consider genuinely satanic serial killers throughout the 70s and early 80s. Like these were actually things that were happening and going on, and people were putting their own sort of cultural neuroses onto these isolated events, and then blowing them wildly up out of proportions. But, you know, moral panics don't come out of nowhere. There is an issue with immigration. Are we taking too many? We are taking on more people than we can build houses for. This is an A-B math conversation. Mm-hmm. So how much can we expand housing capacity and the capacity of the welfare state to accommodate the growth that we actually need to perpetuate our economic growth? This is a math conversation. There shouldn't actually be an emotional valence attached to it one way or the other. But there is. There's a deep emotional valence attached to it. So, and as I said, any of these other issues, you can make the same kinds of observations about.
Hey there. Just so you know, Mo and I are not just the queens of podcasting.
I'm not sure we're even that, but do go on.
We're not part-time cowgirls.
We just made that up.
But we are writers. We're writers.
Wendy and I write a newsletter on Substack. It's a weekly roundup of thoughts and experiences, sometimes serious, often not.
Yeah, you're pretty funny. You write about falling down a lot. You write about your dog.
I do. You write about sex and politics and COVID.
All very, very serious things. We have a few thousand subscribers, both free and paid.
And you could be one of them if you'd like. Just go to Substack.com. And look us up by name or go to our website at womenofillrepute.com and sign up there. We'd love to meet you there.
And now back to being the queens of podcasting.
Yeah, sure.
The Women of Ill Repute.
Bringing the personality into a discussion that may not require it, but I'm curious as to, I have to say, speaking of satanic serial killers, what do you think of Pierre Poilievre? And that's a joke. That's a joke, everyone.
Yeah.
But the question is real.
I don't know if I have the information I require to judge him as a person, bluntly. I mean, how much of Pierre Poilievre is that we see in public is a persona versus a kind of construction that is appealing to a real emotional desire for change in the country, right? Like, versus how much of that is a person. I think I see hints of a fairly thoughtful and conservative individual who genuinely wants to fix some real problems. And I see a lot of own the lib buffoonery, right? And it's the own the lib buffoonery that people respond to very clearly. I mean, the other thing too is like, it's not just a matter of like those, in a parallel way that I said earlier in this podcast, it's not my job as pundit to sit here and dictate to people what to think. I'm telling you what I think. The relationship between the pundit and the audience is more symbiotic than that. Likewise, it's not the politicians just taking advantage of these emotionally fraught issues. It's their base and their audience responding to them talking about issues that that base cares about and is worried about, right? So again, it's a symbiotic back and forth relationship. And I think that we don't always necessarily detach ourselves enough from the play that's happening in front of us to see that.
It's fascinating. I saw the, I guess you'd done a podcast and it started with a poll saying that nobody gives a shit about politics anymore, but they hate Pierre Trudeau. So it's, is that true? Like nobody, I mean, you write a lot about political issues and you care a lot about politics. I still do.
I built a career on it. Like it's, I don't write about these things because there's no interest in them. I couldn't build an audience. I'm not that talented. I can't make an audience happen for topics that people don't care about. I mean, look, I could write about sewing in Dune. And occasionally I do, and the audience will follow me there. But like, there's a limit. I couldn't devote my entire life to writing about sewing and Dune, right? It's a reflection of where the interest of the people actually is. And I'm not sure. I think that people don't like how I'll make another analogy here. When you poll people and you say, what don't you like about the modern media landscape? They'll be like, too much opinion journalism. Hate those opinion journalists. We need more like investigative reporting, goddammit. But then you look at what they actually read and pay for, and what is it? It's opinion journalism. Like, you vote with your feet and your wallet, people. This is just what it is. And there's a reason why every single media outlet, as we have every single one across the globe, as we have obtained better and better ability to track what people read and what they spend their time reading and listening to and click on, they have over time become more and more and more opinion-based, or at least more voicey, right? At least more analytical, right? There's a reason why they've done that. It's opinion is relatively cheaper than investigative journalism. It's an economic incentive. It's also a reflection of where the readers are. If there was overwhelming reader demand for a lot of the things that we say we value, we would have more of it.
I just wish that people were reading two sides of an argument. You can say that in the past that, you know, people made an effort and maybe it was real and maybe it wasn't, but at least there was an effort. Now it's just, here's my opinion. And who knows, are people just following everyone who they agree with, or are they reading a bunch of stuff? So I don't know. I'm married to an Irish guy who didn't grow up here, and he very much identifies with people wanted to come here, wanted to have a better life as he did. But he also misses, I think, that the lack of tradition, the lack of cohesion, and the lack of, so it's really complicated. I don't know what the question is and all that.
Ireland is a really interesting example because, of course, the idea that, you know, you had a daily newspaper that presented all of your peas, carrots, and dessert intellectually in one sort of morning read.
Sounds good.
And it sounds great. It was fantastic. It was also a really short-term thing. It was anomalous historically. The more traditional media model, which is what we're actually going back to, is something closer to like a 6th and 18th century media model, which is that you have an absolute cacophony of voices and opinions and newspapers that cater to those specific voices and opinions. And, you know, your own ideology or your own worldview, you had a real smorgasbord of potential publications and outlets and writers whom you would gravitate toward in alignment with that. Was that a better or worse or more or less democratic model? I don't know. I don't try to apply a moral judgment to it. It's just what we're returning to. So the idea of like the model of media that we've become accustomed to in our lifetimes, that I just think we should remember that is historically anomalous.
Yeah, but we're still here. It's only been 50 years.
No, it was, but it was a brief historical anomalous. But the idea of objective journalism in with the traditional sense, that was not the norm for the majority of the journalists of the time of journalism, the history of the printed press. What was far more normal was what we're coming into now, which is chaos and filter bubbles. And also I would point out the past was also much more chaotic and violent. So are we going back to that? I don't know. The horse has so left the barn on that, that it's hard for me to apply a moral judgment to it or to lament the good old days. I mean, I can't lament the good old days because I never had any good old days. Like I came into media so far past its best before date. I was at the Post, I think a decade after they stopped pulling around the martini cart on Fridays. I mean, I never got the martini cart. And I'm feeling a little resentful about that. But that was just the reality. So I don't have a lot of personal nostalgia for like 90s journalism. It's just, I wasn't in this game until basically the internet had destroyed it. And I've been in my entire career in journalism has been one of decline, right? Mm-hmm. One of managed decline. So I don't look at modern newsrooms and with a lot of, I'm not saying rosy. I had great early experiences, great early mentorship. But the path that I was able to take to journalism no longer exists. It's been utterly obliterated. And the training that I had no longer exists. It's been utterly obliterated. And even the time that I spent in it, I can't look back on that time with a lot of rosy glasses. I attended more funerals than retirement parties. Let's just put it that way.
What are they teaching in journalism schools? And you're closer to this, Jen, than Wendy and I are. But I wonder, because, you know, both Wendy and I went to Ryerson in what was called Radio and Television Arts, and even that name sounds so archaic. What are the tenets of journalism now? I mean, we're all podcasters now and writers, and that's it.
Yeah.
That's it as far as I can see. I mean, anybody who tells me, oh, well, you know, I read the news on television. Well, good for you. How long is that going to last? Is this the path now? Is this, are we the established path now?
I don't think there is an established path now.
Maybe that's not a bad
thing. And also, I regret to inform you, but I've been out of journalism school for a really long time.
Yeah,
it's actually not as long as you. Like, I suspect that you know, we're going to look back on history and say, like, people of my age were kind of like the transitional. Was this transitional moment where I still had like a lot of the traditional journalism training and mindset? But I was also sort of at the beginning of seeing that change. I mean, to see me as being establishment now is just hilarious to me, because I was always such a little shit in my 20s. I was challenging my editors. I was an asshole. But anyway, writing blogs and all that sort of stuff. Like, I remember I had this terrible Blogspot post where I was, you know, in the Toronto Star radio room, basically shitting on other editorial decisions. Like, it was just, you know,
on your blog.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, now I see 20-year-olds doing this on Twitter and I'm like, well, fuck you.
Yeah. You know? Like, in some ways, there's a lot more freedom because we can say what we think.
Yeah.
And especially, you know, in podcasting where we don't work for, I was going to say the man. Oh my God, what is it, 1972? But we don't have a higher up to say you can or can't do that. But at the same time, society itself is far less permissive, I think. And far more quick to judge, and the internet's full of people who think who have a voice as well.
We've created a kind of moral panopticon for ourselves, and you're as constrained by that panopticon by two things. One is how you actually make your bread and what you can afford to say, and the ability of the institutions you work for to withstand basically mob disapproval. And some places have very strong institutional frameworks for that now, and some don't. Or you can just be an independent bitch like me, and I'm like, come at me, cancel me all you want, I don't care. In which case, there is no restraint. I can say exactly what I think, and I don't feel restrained in the least. But that's a certain type of personality. Not everybody's going to be that. As for journalism school, I mean, it's a really interesting conversation. I mean, I don't feel qualified to say how journalism school is being taught now. I do would notice that I look at the teachers who are teaching at Toronto Metropolitan University, formerly Ryerson, and I don't recognize any of them but one. So I don't know what to make of that. I think there's two sort of approaches to journalism, and neither of them are good or bad, but they're just two approaches that live in tandem with one another. One is an analytical approach to journalism and one is an activist approach to journalism. And I think the fundamental difference between the two approaches is that one is fixated on securing, the activist approach is fixated on securing an outcome, and the analytical approach is fixated on just explaining what the world as it is without any particular attachment to an outcome.
I find that really interesting. We're going to have to wrap in a minute or two.
We haven't even talked about makeup and sewing and making your own clothes and...
You know, it's your podcast. You can make it as long as you want.
Oh, that is true.
Well, I have a question about, you do a podcast on The Line. So, sure. I mean, and now you're writing a book and you've got a couple of kids and we think you're an activist, but you're insisting that you're not an activist.
How I define activism is I'm not attached to any outcome.
Right.
Trudeau wins another term. Pierre wins another term. Jeremy Singh wins another term. A meteor hits the earth and we all enter the sweet death cloud of the end. I mean, like, I don't see myself as, my job is to convince anybody or make anybody believe with me or make anybody agree with me or to try and manipulate anyone into my preferred outcome. That's not my role.
Well, maybe that's not what you want, but that's what, I think it's part of what you accomplish.
But that's how people choose to take and interpret my words is that's on their responsibility.
Yeah.
That's not my intent. And I think that I love doing the work for the sake of doing the work for the sake of doing the work. That's it. I just enjoy it. It's fun for me.
So how is The Line doing? I mean, it's a business and you want absolutely. To make money and you want to, Correct. You're writing a book and you've got a couple of kids and you're married and all kind. How's it going?
No, I'm busy. I'm really tired. I'm so tired. No, I mean, it's the business side of journalism is really interesting. Building up the ability to have the craft to be able to do the writing is interesting, but figuring out how to make a business work out of it is also interesting. I mean, one of the values or one of the interesting approaches that we've taken is that by going independent, Matt and I can fully realize the value of our own labor.
So Matt Gurney is your partner,
My partner in the line, which is one way to get, you know, paid, right? It's great. It's really hard to move from that into the next sort of, for lack of a better metaphor, an energy state, sort of how do you make it into a business that has value in and of itself, regardless of whether or not Matt and I are in it? How do we make the line be valuable if it's not Matt and Jen, right? Like that's and therefore an asset in and of itself. How do we scale out? How do we hire people so that we can scale the value from a subscription-based model or even an advertised model, or an even like a, okay, you're paying to be on Jen and Matt's podcast to, now we have people working for us that help us increase the value of this product, right? Like it's a different way of thinking about relationships in the world. And it's a really interesting approach and it's an interesting challenge. It's an interesting puzzle.
So a mouthy babe who cares about money. This is good.
Oh, who doesn't? Can we have to care about money?
You can't not care about money. Like this is there is no way. Like I would love to be able to say that I live in a cloistered convent and I serve the world by offering up my opinions as if from God and I give them up. Like, but that's not the world as it works. If you want to save the journalism industry, you have to start by saving yourself, right? And if I can't make I'm not trying to get like some stupid money, but if I can't pay my mortgage, I can't pay my daycare bills, if I can't, you know, function as an adult, an independent adult in the world, then who am I to be saying or criticizing anything about the industry, right? Like you have to, you can't avoid thinking about money. You can't avoid thinking about the business side of it.
Well, you know what? We can make this podcast as long as we want, but actually, and I don't mind telling you, Wendy and I have a meeting with a potential sponsor who may want us to be the faces of vaginal
money.
Dryness.
Oh. So.
Well,
that's wonderful.
You got to do what you got to do.
You got to do what you got to do. You take your income where you can, man.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I have no moral opposition to it. It's just embarrassing. Jen Gerson, you're a delight. You really are.
I find it so interesting. I mean, it's a safe assumption to make about many journalists that they see themselves as afflicting the comfortable or whatever. And Jen Gerson is very obvious about, no, I'm not. I'm just laying out my opinion and you can think whatever you want. And if you think that afflicting the comfortable is your goal, then you are an activist and I am a journalist. So it's a really interesting way of seeing the world, I think. So it's...
No, and it's also clarifies, brings great clarity. It's just like, I'm not there to persuade you. Although, I mean, I would argue every time you sit down to write anything, you are taking a viewpoint that you want to convey, and therefore you are being persuasive. So I don't think it's that black and white. But that being said, I mean, her opinions are certainly to the right of mine. But that being said, everything that I've read of hers, I understand. I don't 100% agree with, but I agree with a little bit. Even if it were the other way around, even if I was reading someone who was more left of center than me and who could persuade me or at least have me agree with their opinion, I think is a good thing. The worst thing that can happen is to be entrenched in your opinions and completely inflexible. And
I always
think there are
read
too many
her.
People like that.
I
know you
her.
Do. You're a huge fan and you got me onto her, and I'm going to subscribe to The Line, which is her podcast. I guess we have to support podcasts like this one. Please don't make us
dryness.
The faces of vaginal dryness. That's for real. We got a meeting coming up, so we're going to let you go.
Women of Ill Repute was written and produced by Maureen Holloway and Wendy Mesley, with the help from the team at the Sound Off Media Company and producer Yet Belgraver.
I'm Andrea Askowitz.
And I'm Allison Langer. And we are the hosts of Writing Class Radio, a podcast, but we are so much more. We have writing classes. So if you are looking for live online classes where you can join a community, write to a prompt, get feedback, and get better, check out all our classes at writingclassradio.com.
and listen to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts and at writingclassradio.com.